From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in downtown San Francisco.
I'm in the Mission.
Oakland, 33rd and Telegraph.
Off Piedmont Avenue.
Border of Oakland and Berkeley.
Emeryville, California. Woo, represent.
Coming up, a look into how much teachers are spending out of pocket to make sure their classrooms are ready for the school year.
I know that when you do your taxes, you can deduct up to $500, and I'm usually over that.
Then a musician who spent his career bringing other people into the mix.
It seems like I've been put on the planet to remind people that music is too important to be left to the professionals.
And we'll learn the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
Hands are ringing balance now. Spin to the right.
Getting into the swing of things today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Walk into any drug or dollar store right now, and what you'll see prominently displayed are school supplies. Here in the Bay Area, where schools have just started, it's not just students and parents buying them, it's also teachers. KALW's Hannah Kingsley Ma set out to find out why and check out one of the more unusual places to get classroom staples for free. And a note to our listeners, KALW's license is held by the San Francisco Unified School District.
There's a warehouse in San Francisco's Bayview neighborhood, stuffed with the severed legs of aging mannequins, screws of various sizes, large pieces of real fur. It's called SCRAP, Scroungers Center for Reusable Art Parts, a nonprofit recycling center. And while it might seem like a necessary pit stop before Burning Man, today it's full of another crew of diehards, teachers, more than 200 of them.
So I got a bunch of tiles, paper, pencils, manila folders for portfolios.
That's Corbray Smith, known to his students as Mr. C. He teaches sixth grade art in an Oakland charter school, and he's taking advantage of a teacher giveaway today at SCRAP. The center has set aside free donated materials that might be useful to teachers. Things like binders, stacks of old National Geographic magazines, markers, and picture books. Smith's carrying load after load to his car.
This is my seventh trip. Yeah, I took everything.
Smith is excited about this free bundle of goods because usually...
I'm typically, though, spending all of my money.
Smith's not alone. The average American teacher spends $500 out of pocket on classroom supplies. Right now, California school funding looks better than it did during the recession, when school budgets were slashed by $20 billion. And Smith says his classroom budget's pretty generous. So why doesn't he make more art supply orders through school? He says bureaucracy.
It takes a long time to get reimbursed. And sometimes you just have a need, and you just need to do it.
And after meetings and lesson planning and working with kids all day, filling out paperwork to justify purchasing paper and paint, it just isn't really worth it to him. At a bin near Corbray Smith, a preschool teacher withdraws in horror from a pile of plastic bottle caps.
I'm seeing stuff like, okay, not infant friendly.
Lenny De Leon teaches preschool. And she won't pick up anything an infant or toddler could swallow. Her school, Holy Family Day Home, is one of the oldest preschools in the city, and it mainly serves kids from low-income families. She takes her job as their first teacher very seriously.
It's like we have to feed that brain. We have to nurture it and, you know, get them to a good start, giving them positive experiences, since like this is what a school is like. This is what a school should be.
She's eyeing color charts because she believes her classroom should be filled with beautiful things.
I want them to see just materials that, you know, they wouldn't typically see at home. Beautiful materials. I want them to get excited.
But mostly she's collecting practical items here at SCRAP. Notebooks for teachers, staplers, and index cards. She has a small budget for classroom supplies.
And I'm just like, you know, I'm saving that for something really important.
Like if a CD player breaks, or they need to buy a new computer. So when she can't pick the basics up at SCRAP, she usually just buys them.
You know, I just kind of spend along the way. I try not to keep track of it, just because I really don't want to know how much I'm really spending.
Rachel Castro, who teaches at a different San Francisco preschool, already spent $200, and school's just started.
I know that that when you do your taxes, you can deduct up to $500, and I'm usually over that.
Anne-Marie Thielon, the founder of Scrap, thinks this is outrageous. She says she once went to a luncheon with bankers.
And I asked them, do your employees pay for their supplies to do their work? Why would teachers have to pay for their own supplies? And it's really a disgrace.
She opened Scrap in 1976 to help educators and artists source cheap materials. The school district owns this warehouse, so Scrap gets it rent-free. In return, they sell items at low cost year-round and host these free giveaways for teachers 9 times a year. You can find Thielon at the counter, wearing a beret, chatting with customers.
Yeah, I'm a teacher.
Oh, you're a teacher.
Yeah.
What do you teach?
I teach theater.
Oh. A few free packs of glue sticks, some crayons, they might seem small. But Thielon knows over time these things add up, especially as the rising cost of living is becoming prohibitive for many Bay Area teachers.
We need to really protect teachers because teachers are essential.
Preschool teacher Lenny De Leon agrees. She says she knows she'll go above and beyond to make her students' experiences positive, and so will educators everywhere.
I think teachers just kind of are just giving people, and they're just, you know, we just do whatever it takes out of our pocket.
But she also resents the unspoken expectation she feels from many non-teachers, that doing her job well has to come at her own expense.
You should just do it because you love to do the job.
Yeah.
No. I cannot stress that enough.
What De Leon wants, she says, is true respect for the important and difficult work she does. And maybe that starts with her not having to buy her own Post-its. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Kingsley Ma.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. San Francisco musician Joshua Raul Brody grew up in a musical family just outside New York City, where he loved listening to comedic songwriters like Tom Lehrer and Alan Sherman. He started playing in rock bands in high school, then attended the prestigious Berklee College of Music in Boston. Then he moved to San Francisco in 1974, where he discovered a whole community of like-minded artists combining music and comedy. He's been a staple of the San Francisco music scene ever since. KALW's Jen Chien talked to Joshua Raul Brody about why music is not a spectator sport.
When did you first start playing music?
Long enough ago that I should be a whole lot better. I was raised in a very musical family, so possibly as early as 4, I started messing around on the keyboard and spent the next 4 years begging my parents to let me take piano lessons. And then I spent the next 6 years begging them to let me stop.
Was it the practice that got to you?
It was the practice.
So at what point between age 4 and going to Berklee College of Music, or maybe now, did you discover that that's what you wanted to do for the rest of your life?
Right. It wasn't until I was playing in rock bands in high school and early college. And then I was taking it seriously enough to want to go to Berklee. But again, academics and regular discipline weren't in my cards. And I was also really interested in the synthesis of music and comedy.
And so now you, you play a lot of different gigs, but one of them is with the Bay Area Theater Sports Improv Group.
Yeah.
And so that sounds like what you're talking about, a marriage of music and comedy together.
Exactly.
So tell me about how playing music in that setting is different from playing music in other settings.
Well, the improv is the key word there. I'm making stuff up just as much as the people on stage are making stuff up. Sometimes I'll make a a musical pun by quoting an existing song that people are familiar with. But a lot of my work is accompanying people who are making up songs. And I'm making up the music while they're making up the words and melody.
So how does that just logistically work? Who's leading and who's following? And
I like to say that in an ideal world, neither of us is leading and we're both following the song. The song is doing the leading. It doesn't always work out that way. And depending on the experience of the singer and how much confidence they bring to bear, sometimes I'm leading them and sometimes they're totally driving and I'm doing my best to keep up.
And what do you find enjoyable about that? Sounds like it could be stressful.
The first time I accompanied an improv group was in 1979 with Robin Williams at the Comedy Store. I thought I was going to die. And I'm not being hyperbolic. I actually thought my heart was going to stop beating.
Did you have a sort of panic attack?
Yeah, I had a panic attack. I got through it. And I thought, well, I got through it. Next time will be easier. And the second time, I thought I was going to die. It was after that second time that I didn't die, I realized feeling like you're going to die is not the same thing as actually dying. And then I started finding ways to enjoy it. So long as you got past that fear thing, you start playing with the different aspects of it. It's like dials on a mysterious science fiction machine. What does this one do? And you get to see the results instantly. You play a major chord and the singer responds one way. You play a minor chord, they respond another way. You play a lot, they respond another way. You don't play anything, and they keep going. So there are no mistakes. That's the watchword of improvisation. And that was a great liberation for me.
That does sound fun.
It was just a few years ago that I discovered that there's another theme in my work aside from music and comedy. And that's that it seems like I've been put on the planet to remind people that music is too important to be left to the professionals. That you don't need a Pulitzer Prize or a contract with the publishing house to write an email. You don't need to be cooking in a 4-star restaurant to make yourself bacon and eggs. But for some reason, people feel that you need a certain amount of talent, innate talent or training, in order to make any kind of music at all. And I can't count the number of times people have told me, no, you don't want to hear me sing. I do want to hear you sing. I want to hear everybody sing. And I think if everybody sang all the time and didn't just follow the artificial rules that you see on American Idol, the world would be a better place. So everything I do, from accompanying improvisation to teaching song improvisation to teaching in grade schools to teaching through the opera, my Beatles thing that I accompany audience members on their favorite Beatles songs. It's all about enabling people to enjoy the wonderful gift that is making music live.
It's a participatory art, yeah. Not just you sit
exactly.
There and I sit here.
Exactly. It's not a consumer thing. It's a participatory thing.
That was KALW's Jen Cheehan talking to musician Joshua Raul Brody. He'll be playing music for the Bay Area Theater Sports Improv musical show Bats Does the Bechdel Test. That's tomorrow and Saturday night at the Bayfront Theater in San Francisco's Fort Mason. All the details are at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. For our next story, we're going to hear from another improviser, one who specializes in jazz. By day, Lauren Benedict works as a theoretical and computational physicist at Lawrence Livermore Labs. His job description sounds something like this.
I work on properties of materials or predicting the properties of materials, chiefly at extreme conditions of temperature and pressure, like at the center of giant planets or in stars.
But by night, what Benedict does sounds more like this.
Feather-weaving, high-foot, wagu-tram-fu, feather-twin-vin-fug-up, white-vething, weather-weaving, sing-heavers-in-drim-saw.
Want to know more? Let's listen.
My name is Lauren Benedict, and I live in Oakland, and I am, I guess, what I would term a scat singer. So I use my voice essentially as an instrument.
Farat, Shrimvin, Bot, Swinvin, Drew, Twinvin, D, Lifin, Thought, Finvin, Vethu, Boevis, and Fop, Sin, Vethu, Hyvethu, Fin, Soost.
When I first started performing, people would ask, hey, that sounds pretty good, but aren't you ever going to sing words? And after a certain period, that kind of questioning stopped. It became not, are you going to sing words, but what language is that?
Strim sost, live at the vin, vedo high by the uten vendor will belim vin suit. Wadoo wong in win fin sahut.
The thing that I hear the most is that it sounds German. I have heard the Scandinavian thing before. I've also heard Yiddish. But needless to say, I'm not a speaker of any language other than English. And so I don't know really where this is coming from. Other than it's just sort of what comes natural to me.
Feather the wee, you fun the hoover, even you have other hoover, will the lopman wind spink, but wouldn't vendor wind rim, me be be. My van vin drop, weep, vibe the wee, have other hoover, weave as in van in winzing, whether the lop finzing, whether.
When I was a little kid, my sister and I had this sort of made up language, which was not representational. I mean, the words didn't really mean anything, and we didn't pretend that they meant anything. This set of syllables didn't stand for something. It was just more to invoke feeling or evoke feeling. And I think I've always felt, even when I was a little kid, that a large amount of actual communication, even with conventional language, is done above and beyond sort of linguistic particulars. And so the very simple illustration of this would be, we had a little dog, and my stepmother and my sister insisted that the dog understood English, and my father and myself, the rational males, insisted that that couldn't be the case. And for instance, the stepmother would say to the little dog, "Laddie, come here and sit down," and then I would say, "Drim swindil bin troll bin drim beel," and then you do the same damn thing. So I mean, that sort of proved my point, but it also, in a sense, set me on this course because it sort of taught me that you can convey a lot with that above and beyond literal meaning. I come from a family of instrumental musicians that are all professionals, that are actually none of them improvisers, but all come from the Western classical tradition. They are or were in various major orchestras. I'm a pretty hard-headed guy, and so, of course, it was the case that my parents tried to get me to play an instrument when I was younger, and I did not take to it at all. It was the violin, actually, when I was 6 years old. And as soon as I could get away with not ever doing it again, that's what I did. And I knew I wanted to be a scientist, and that's it. And that was also encouraged. My dad actually has a PhD in physics, even though he's a bassoonist. So I was only going to do music if it was on my terms.
That was scat singer and theoretical physicist Lauren Benedict. That piece was produced by KELW's Julie Kane. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KELW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
Hands, swing this neighbor. Hands in a ring and balance now. Spin to the right. Raven, lead your neighbor out.
The thing that's nice about the gender neutral is you can dance with anyone.
Shadow a neighbor. Back to your partner. Partner, swing.
Did you think that was a square dance? Well, close, but not quite. It's contra, a social dance with roots in the kind of English country balls that you might have seen in Pride and Prejudice, mixed with lots of moves familiar to square dancers, all set to live string band music.
We sent KALW's Bonnie Chan to Oakland to find out more about what makes this one so unique.
Right shoulder round. And swing this neighbor.
It's a Friday night at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Oakland, and the hall is packed. But this is not a religious service.
Start to the right with your shadow and neighbor. Back to your partner. Partners, swing.
It's Circle Left Contra Dance, a monthly social gathering that brings people together to twirl, swing, and do-si-do their hearts out.
Some people describe it as a bit like a square dance, but instead of dancing with just the people in your square, you're actually dancing with the entire room.
That's Yo-Yo Joe, one of the main organizers of Circle Left. He started the event with friends 3 years ago.
The norm in contra dancing is that you change partners every dance, so there's only a small amount of embarrassment that you have to endure with one partner before you move on to the next.
There are lots of contra dance socials in the Bay Area. But Circle Left is the only one that's gender neutral, which means that the traditional dance roles for ladies and gents are replaced with roles called ravens and larks.
There are a lot of people who are less comfortable with the standard language of contra dancing, which is important because the caller might be telling you to do something as the ladies or the gents, and there's nothing inherent about one's gender that applies to the dance moves that you're doing.
The thing that's nice about the gender neutral is you can dance with anyone.
This is Del Powell, a longtime contra dancer.
I can dance both parts, so anyone here I can dance with.
The room is filled with stomping and clapping as dancers swing their partners around. There are all kinds of fashion statements here. People rocking braided beards, silk shirts, cowboy boots, clogs and ballet flats. And there are also plenty of flying skirts on both men and women, courtesy of a skirt table in the back of the hall.
A lot of times there's like new people who've never been here before that get really excited about the skirt table and have never worn skirts before. And so that's a cool opportunity. And I think it's something that makes the dance a little bit queer and more gender inclusive and exciting.
And Circle Left is no place for wallflowers. If you come to this contra dance, you better be ready to take a spin with pretty much everybody in the room. And if you don't know how to do the dance sequence, don't worry. Just follow what the caller's telling you to do.
It might sound something like this. With your neighbor, balance and swing.
With these neighbors, circle left, circle left. Great place.
Join hands, circle to the left.
Balance now, California twirl. Neighbor, balance and swing.
I love coming because it's a really welcoming community. So it's like easy to join in.
A couple of dancers sitting at one of the songs told me it's the community aspect that keeps them coming to Circle Left. And one thing you might notice about the room is that everyone is grinning, even the beginners who are facing the wrong way.
It's not like other dance situations where you're kind of like not sure what you're supposed to do or like you feel like people are judging you.
I didn't know what I was getting into at all.
Is this your first night?
Yes, and I like the spinning part.
Hey, hey, Lark, pass by the left.
There's a beginner's class before each Circle Left event, just in case you want a little introduction before the main event gets underway. And if all else fails and you get a little lost out there on the dance floor, Yo-Yo Joe's got some advice. When someone comes up to you with their hands out, just grab onto them and enjoy the ride. In Oakland, I'm Bonnie Chan for Cross Currents.
The music you heard in this piece was by the Raggedy Anns. If you'd like to take a spin as a raven or a lark, the next Circle Left dance is coming up on September 9th. And we had a winner this week. Big congrats to Emma Lyerly, who knew exactly where we recorded. Yay, Emma! We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, next week's sound is one with a lot of history in the Bay Area. Ready for your sneak listen?
There's a time when the
operation of the machine becomes so odious.
Hey, if you want to take a flyer?
Makes you so sick at heart.
We're showing a demonstration of what it's like to go through an Israeli checkpoint.
We're trying to get the UC Regents to divest from fossil fuels.
But you can't take part. You can't even passively take part.
Okay, I bet a lot of you know exactly where we recorded that one. Give us a call and tell us all about it. 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We love hearing from you. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. And thank you for listening. That's all for today. Our team includes Bonnie Chan, Jurgen Klem, Leila Day, Jeremy Dalmas, Olivia Henry, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Seltzer. Today's show was engineered by James Rowlands. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This song is by Bay Area blues powerhouse Kim Nally. Kim Nally performs Saturday at the Biscuits and Blues Club off Union Square in San Francisco. Her show starts at 7:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hana Baba.
The National Guard has been deployed on the forgotten, the oppressed, and unemployed. Michael Brown is dead, and they still haven't arrested that policeman.